Hello, and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker. And I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She's a sex therapist. And today, on today's episode, we are looking back at 2023.
Yeah, last week you did your favorite episode, our net neutrality conversation. And this week, it is my turn to share my favorite episode. And I suspect you might be a little bit surprised by what I picked.
Is it the cyber brothel?
It is not, although that was my number two.
That was so much fun.
Yeah, that was definitely, I think, one of the more interesting experiences that we had this year. But it ended up being our second most interesting experience. And the episode that I picked is our telling the story of what I think ended up being the most interesting, I can't say thing we did, but the most interesting thing that happened in 2023. And that is the story of how our con almost got conned.
Yeah. That's surprising me that you'd pick this one.
So here's my rationale. I am, as you know, a therapist. And one of the things that can be a tricky thing in the world of therapy is that a lot of people look at mental health providers and they're like, but you know how to do it. You know human emotion. You know relationships. You know communication. You know conflict resolution. So why are you ever getting anything wrong ever, right? Like every therapist should theoretically have the world's most perfect life because we're trained in helping other people to improve their own lives. And there's kind of this misperception that because we have information, we are always perfect at applying it. And I think the same is also true for folks in your world, that even people that know all of the best steps to take and all of the right tools to have in place and all of the correct procedures to be aware of, things still happen, right? Like there would be no Target breach. There would be no healthcare hacking if every cybersecurity expert was perfectly implementing everything every time. And so I thought that this idea of, you know, like the fallibility of people in your world and in my world was really interesting because we both tend to move in spaces where the assumption is we know what to do so that we don't have these problems. And yet, you and I had these problems this year. Not the relationship ones so much, but the potential breaches, the attacks, the vulnerabilities. And I think that telling those stories is so important. In my world, we call that therapeutic disclosure. These times where a therapist might tell something, a personal story from their own life or an experience that they've had, because telling that story will benefit the client. Telling that story will teach the client something about their own life, their own goals. And this, to me, kind of feels like the securing sexuality version of a therapeutic disclosure, right? We've spent the entire year telling people how to keep themselves safe. And that might sometimes give people the impression that you and I know how to live a risk-free life. But I think that our experience in October goes a long way to showing people that even the ones that theoretically know it, even the ones that on paper have the tools, life still happens and reality still intervenes and sometimes bad stuff occurs. And so I thought that as we move into 2024 and people are thinking about what they want to do differently in the year ahead, what they want to add to their lives, eliminate from their lives, reflect on, that sharing a story of a time when you and I, even as we practice what we preach, almost had that not work out was a really important way to end the year.
I think that's lovely. And I would say, you know, just the counterpoint is, if anyone's listening to this, you know, I've got a sex therapist as a wife, which means I've got the perfect wife. I mean, everything always works. We communicate great. Everything is fantastic from the kitchen to the bedroom to the cloud. So in case, I just want to like combat what you said there just a little bit. And also, all my stuff is completely secure.
So with that said, with the caveats that the story we are about to share, We Got Conned, doesn't actually reflect any failings or imperfections on our part whatsoever. Let's time travel back to late October and hear about that time when we threw a conference and got attacked. The thing we've been telling you guys about all year long happened, and it was pretty cool, actually.
So we're going to go quick to one audio clip to give you a sense of what it was like.
What have you liked most about the conference thus far?
I think what I've enjoyed the best is being able to bring my IT husband to the conference, because as a therapist, there are so few times it feels like we can integrate what we do together. But this is just another opportunity to engage and see that, like, there are ways that we can make parallels to our careers. And the good thing about that is that it lets you have those metaphors and those journeys with other organizations and other careers. And I think it's just another great opportunity for us to see there's so much that we can do together for the people that are coming and seeking out our help throughout any resource or for any resources or any career path. So yeah, that's been a really cool time to see.
That was what I was hoping to get out of this, right? Stephanie has like this idea of community and togetherness and this idea of being authentic and this idea of, from your world, bringing the rigor, and from my world, bringing the eccentricity, I guess.
Fun. I just said.
And so sold out, packed event, but at the height of everything going great, at the height of, like, this is our moment, right? When you and I are about to take the stage and introduce our keynotes, and we've got all these people in the ballroom, and we're downtown Detroit, and it's a beautiful day, and the sun's coming in, and you can see the Detroit landscape, and the food is coming, you know, in the back of the room. You can smell the food, and everyone's ready. We're about to take the stage. That's the moment where we almost lost it all.
Yeah, I mean, anybody that's known us for more than 30 seconds or listened to more than one episode of this podcast will know that you and I don't do anything on easy mode, and we always walk away with a story. I feel like I had expected our story to be, we did a conference and it was awesome and everybody wants us to do it again. And that is part of the story. But there's also, like, this whole secret backstory that a lot of our conference attendees didn't know about, didn't see. A couple of them heard about it after the fact, but this is sort of the big reveal of what happened behind the curtains at the Securing Sexuality Conference.
So to set the stage, we'd expected something might go awry, right? We had some controversial speakers. This idea of protecting bodily autonomy and this idea of protecting the pursuit of pleasure isn't necessarily always viewed positively in all circles of the world. We had expected that not everyone was going to appreciate what was going on. And so as people were filing in and you and I were getting ready to take the stage, a series of texts comes in.
It started out just one text. And it was one that looked like a million other text messages that I've gotten, right? It was from our bank, and it just said, you know, hey, somebody tried to buy something at Best Buy for this amount. Was that you? Press 1 for yes or 2 for no. It clearly was not me, so I pressed 2 for no, and I went about my business. And just a minute or two later, my phone rang. And they told me it was our bank's fraud alert division, that they had registered that I had said 2 for no, and that they wanted to reach out because they also saw a pending Zelle transaction trying to come out of our account for $5,000. And they're like, if this Best Buy transaction isn't you, we wanted to call and make sure that this Zelle was you. And dear readers, it was not, in fact, me. And that began our grand adventure.
And so a couple of things here. First off, the text message was from a number that had texted us before from the bank. The phone number was actually from the fraud department. So it was the same number that you would call if you were going to report fraud?
Yeah. Okay. So the phone call starts off about 45 minutes of me on the phone. And, you know, at any other point in time, I'm married to a cybersecurity expert. Usually I would pull you aside and throw you on the phone. This is what you do. This is your wheelhouse, not mine. But again, this happened as all of our conference attendees were pouring into the ballroom for our first keynote on our first day. And so, you know, I can handle it. I step out of the ballroom. I'm frustrated because I'm missing our amazing speaker, but it's a really easy thing to get resolved. And I'm on the phone. And at a certain point, they say, we're going to send you a push notification. We need you to do what the instructions say. And this is where sometimes being frazzled and distracted and maybe a little literal comes in really handy, because the message that I got said, you know, please type in password. And in hindsight, I suspect they wanted me to tell them our password. But again, I'm greeting people as I'm on the phone. I have people stopping to ask what's going on, why I'm not at the talk. I'm really frustrated that I'm missing our talk. I'm even more frustrated that I'm missing lunch. And so I do exactly what I am told to do. And I type the word password and I hit send.
That part just amuses me. Please type password. All right. Password. Done. Right. It feels very much like say the word friend and enter, right? That amused me. But at that point in time, we thought that this was someone taking a run at our bank account and that Chase was helping us out. And it sort of made sense. A transfer of that size is above the, you know, automatic minimum. So that would have raised red flags. Gift cards on our debit card would have raised red flags. I am a staunch believer in never using a debit card. If you have a debit card, you set it to a PIN that you promptly forget, and you put the debit card in a drawer where it's promptly forgotten, and you don't have to worry about fraud on those cards, because, of course, debit cards are not protected to the level of like a credit card. But also, as I recall, they like verified a lot of stuff with you. This seemed like the bank, because they were verifying what did they confirm with you?
They knew our address, so they confirmed our address. They tried to confirm the last four of the bank account, but this is both a saving grace and also it could have been, if I had, you know my accounts by heart better, perhaps a red flag a little bit sooner. We have obviously multiple accounts, right? We have our nonprofit that we have set up. I have my clinical practice. We have our individual banking accounts. I don't know all of those off the top of my head. And so they were trying to confirm the last four of an account. And I actually do know my personal account, the last four by heart. And because this was happening in a situation where I was surrounded by people and had lots of things going on and was very distracted, I didn't recognize the account number they were reading to me. And if I had, I would have noticed, you know, to your point about debit cards, that the account they were asking about is not one that we use frequently, that it's not one that I would expect Chase to reach out to me about, because it's not one that we make everyday transactions or purchases with. So had I been a little bit more on the ball, or the kind of person that memorizes all of her bank account numbers by heart, I might have noticed something a little bit sooner, but I didn't. It was easy for me to say, yeah, that sounds like it could be right, because they had already called my phone number. They had already given us our business address, or given me our business address. There was a lot of information that they had that they didn't need to ask me for.
We're trusting that this is the bank, and they are trying to resolve, and I'm saying resolve in air quotes, this problem with Zelle, right? There's this transfer of Zelle, which seemed weird, because from a foundation perspective, from a nonprofit perspective, you take in donations and you pay bills. It's not like a personal account where we're Zelling cash all over the place. So that seemed weird. I recall that they like put you on hold, and there's this whole long conversation about it.
Well, that was part of what made it seem like a fraud was happening, because we don't send or receive Zelles from our nonprofit account. So it makes perfect sense that if there's a Zelle trying to come out, that would be a fraudulent Zelle, because that's not the purpose of our foundation accounts. But this was taking a really long time. And when I say a really long time, I mean a good long time of me sitting on hold while they told me that one fraud person was talking to the Zelle fraud person. And these were not conversations I was privy to. I was literally just sitting on hold. And after about 45 minutes, I was getting really frustrated because we were throwing a conference and there were things I needed to be doing. So they came back on. They said, this is going to take a while for us to untangle. We have to talk to the Zelle team. We have to work on the fraud team. Is there a time when we can call you back? And we set up an appointment for them to call me back at 4:30. And so at that point, you know, I got off the phone. I went back into the ballroom. I very quietly told you that they had caught the fraud, that nothing was going to come out of our account, that they were working on the Zelle piece, and that they were going to call us back later that afternoon. And you and I went about our day thinking that everything was pretty much squared away.
And so for the next few hours, so the keynote was at 11, the keynote went great, although you missed it, I'm sorry. But she did a fantastic job. And I think it was very eye-opening for both the technologists and the sexologists in the room. After that, we had a game. Did you make it back in time for the game?
I did get to see our Jeopardy, yes. Sex Tech Jeopardy went over like gangbusters.
Yeah, that was so cool. So, obviously, Jeopardy is a protected term, so this is Jeopardy inspired.
It was our tribute to Jeopardy. And the slide deck that we use spelled Jeopardy with a T.
And so we had some great questions there. One of the things that was amusing to me is Hacker Jeopardy has a long storied tradition in Hacker Summer Camp, ran by a couple of our friends. And one of our speakers and one of the village, the internet toy hacking village, Render Man of the Internet of Dongs project, had reached out to me. He's like, hey, I am the, you know, X time winner of Hacker Jeopardy. If you want contestants. And I'm thinking, some of our questions were like, what is a password and what is multi-factor? you would really quickly overpower the idea and the spirit of this.
I mean, we wanted to use it as a chance for our therapists to test their technology skills. And that involves starting with, you know, we don't start out in expert mode, but we got there. And some of those $1,000 questions were hard and they were getting them.
You know, the thing that struck me as being just like so wholesome is we didn't know why one of the contestants was trying to not answer all the questions, because this particular contestant was clearly dominating. And why was that they wanted prizes from second place. So when the game wrapped up, all three contestants get together and they laid out all the prizes and they took turns picking out and divvying them up in a fair and equitable way. And that seems so wholesome to me.
It's very much my world coming to the table. I loved it. Every time that contestant buzzed in or got a question right, we could see them getting more and more frustrated. And I couldn't understand why. So it was really lovely to find out afterwards. It's because they really want it to be second place. And so that redistribution of prizes kind of made my day.
That was lovely. It was a great moment. It was a lot of fun. And then we head into our afternoon sessions and talks are going on. And we knew we had this like 4:30 call coming up, and they called early.
They did. They called at 4. And because I am nothing if not chill and low key, my reaction was not concern, but frustration, because they made me walk out of another talk. And guys, we had really good talks. These were people I had been looking forward to hearing and learning from all year. And so getting pulled out of a second one did not mean that I answered my phone with, you know, the greatest of tact or diplomacy. But I did. And I asked them why they were calling me early. And they said that they had to call back sooner because they had been working on the Zelle piece. And now they could see a $40,000 wire transfer trying to come out of our account. And they wanted to know if that was us. And that's when I was no longer chill. And that was when I started to panic a bit. And thankfully, right around the time they're telling me this, the talk slid out. And I see you walk out of a room and you're talking to somebody. And I believe I literally grabbed you by the shirt sleeve and dragged you away. Because at this point, I am tagging in the hacker husband. This is above my pay grade. This is beyond my skill set. And now I want you on the phone with the fraud people.
Now, one of the things that had happened the first time that they called you was they sent a SMS code, so a text message with a one-time password or OTP code, and said, we're sharing this so that we can verify your identity. Please read it back to us. And of course, you did. And so I get involved, and this person is very brusque and very high pressure, which never goes well with me either. I'm like, please hold. And so, by the way, one of the things about social engineering is oftentimes security awareness training or whatnot will teach you the tactics, like look for a misspelling or look for a bad logo, or, you know, check the email headers or any sort of things. But realistically, all cons, for as long as the con game has been afoot, involve a couple of things. They involve the threat of loss. They involve high pressure. We got to take care of this right away. And they tend to hit at a point in time when we know that the person is distracted or otherwise not at their best, right? If you're at your cognitive best, that's not when a con artist is going to go after you. So this started to have all those same senses to it. Now, I didn't quite get that yet, but I knew enough to say, this is a good moment for me to pause and think. So I'm like, please hold. And we walked back to our room and then put him back on speaker. And I think I slid you a piece of paper that said, are you really sure this is the bank?
And at that point, I said, I don't really know. And we asked them to give us a minute to log into our bank account. That way we could see what they were seeing. Because at this point, they had been telling us they have frozen our account, that we don't need to worry about the pending Zelle or the pending wire transfer because they've frozen the account. Now they just need to make sure that we're protected. And where you and I finally had the quiet and the privacy and the space to breathe by going back to our rooms was when they tried to lay the trap, which was, we need to move your money into this other account to make sure it doesn't come out with that wire transfer. And you and I said, great, we have several other accounts. We can do that right now. And that was when the bank fraud person got really frustrated with us.
He did. He's like, well, I'm trying to help you. I can't just keep on the phone, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, please hold.
We weren't seeing fraud alerts on our side. We weren't seeing pending Zelles when we looked at our bank information. We weren't seeing a wire transfer request. And nor were we seeing our account frozen. Everything looked totally normal on our side. And I don't remember what we said, but you took him off of hold and said something. And the bank fraud alert person hung up on us.
Yes.
And that was, I think, the point when we went, okay, clearly this is not our bank.
The concern I had was we did see a pending transfer that was the transfer this, I'm using air quotes, banker was trying to get us to click to process. And this pending transfer would have transferred all our funds to this other bank account. And this other bank account ostensibly was set up for us. But we had no way of logging into it. And this other bank account ostensibly was meant to protect the funds from being stolen from our nonprofit. But they were very reticent to allow us to move those same funds to one of our other accounts. And also this transfer, I mean, literally, guys, it was down to like one click. All they needed to do was convince us to click this one button to send these funds. And my question was, that sounds like a great idea, Mr. Banker. I love the fact that you've set up this other account for us and saved us all sorts of time, as I'm remembering how long it took us to set up our nonprofit bank account in the first place, how much documentation we had to present. But let me ask you this. We have pending checks, you know, speakers and for food and for facilities and everything else. What's going to happen to those checks? And do you remember what the friendly banker told us?
Yes, they could close out our account and move the funds into another account. And the checks that I had written for our speaker honorariums and for our venue and for our caterers and for our AV, those would still go through because for 30 days, the bank would honor the checks I had written off of what was ostensibly about to become a closed account.
And that had me wondering, first off, what a great bank to give us a 30-day line of credit. And second of all, what a great bank to open up account, which the first time we did it took us well over an hour. And that was about the time I think they hung up on us. And so we very quickly, we went to a bank.
Yeah. And when we say quickly, we mean it was after 4:30 by the time this call ended. And we had 30 minutes to get to the bank and have the bank help us. And let me tell you, dear listeners, when the bankers stay late for you, you're in trouble.
This is true. So we book it to the bank. We explain what happened. We withdraw the funds because we can't be sure how far the adversary has gotten into the account. Clearly, they've done quite a bit. We burn the account number and the debit cards to the ground. We move everything over. One of the things that really frustrated me was, it turns out, not surprising anyone at this point in time, our friendly bank fraud department was not the friendly bank fraud department. Our friendly bank fraud department was someone in Texas who had an Android phone, and that SMS text message to verify our identity was actually them setting up the account on the Android phone with the mobile bank app, which they then set up this transfer. And again, all they had to do was convince us to click the button to transfer the funds. This would have been the very last year of our conference. Very last year.
Because as you and the actual bank fraud people who we spoke to sitting in the branch told me, if they move the money out of our account, it's a crime. But if they can convince us to move the money out of our account, we just made a tragic choice and there's nothing anybody can do, right?
Right. Right. And so sitting in the bank at the banker's desk with the actual fraud department on the phone, which we had called, the actual fraud department sends us a text message to confirm our identity.
And asks me to read them the code.
And I'm like, wait, this is exactly what got us into trouble 4 hours ago. What are you doing? And the fraud person says, and I quote, but I'm actually with the bank, so you can trust me.
And to be clear, I had spent the last hours feeling incredibly stupid and incredibly naive. And it just, I was in a shame spiral. And this was my moment, I think, of sort of like mental vindication, because when they sent through that text message with the code they needed me to read back to them, it came up in the exact same text thread that the fraudulent notifications had come up in. It didn't even come up as a separate text, which means that they had spoofed things well enough that had those alerts come in, those initial 11 a.m. alerts come in while I was sitting in a bank with a banker and you sitting next to me, they still would have looked exactly like the bank, because they did look exactly like what the bank sent us.
Yeah, yeah. We learned a few things, or rather remembered a few things, and I'm going to go over them in just a minute. But one of the things I thought was really fascinating about our conference was October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which I always tell you is a big deal. And you always look at me and say, no one knows this and no one cares.
That's not true. I say no one outside of your world knows this and no one outside of your world cares.
So Cybersecurity Awareness Month is apparently only for cybersecurity people. We all make each other aware of how no one's aware of this. And historically, I don't feel that awareness has been all that good or all that useful. But one of the things that we saw again and again in this conference, because of the sexologists and technologists coming together, because of the therapists and hackers hanging out, because of the way that we're mixing things up and making things relevant, was that we actually started to see some like changes, right? People adopting password wallets. And one of my favorites was, and I think this was the Internet of Dongs talk again. So again, shout out to Render Nicole, who have also been on the podcast before. They said, hey, who's using a password wallet? And out of the back, one of the therapists yells out, I can't. I just learned what it was the last session. And I thought that was so great. So we told the story, and we're paying bills, and we're, you know, paying the honorariums. And I love the speakers who reached out and said, okay, so on the topic of bank fraud, I don't know if I should trust this. Did this really come from you guys? I'm like, yes, good. We've made some progress.
Why I wanted to tell the story is, you know, partly because Wolf and I live for a good story, and how can you not tell the tale of almost getting hacked at the HackerCon you threw to help teach the non-hackers how to not be hacked, right? Like, that's just chef's kiss. Also because Wolf is a hacker, and I have spent the last 9 years living with, talking to, socializing with, and hanging out in hacker spaces, and we almost fell for it, you guys. Like, a lot of times when people get breached or when people fall for the stupid phishing attack their boss sends them or any number of things, they feel dumb. They feel stupid. They feel like they should have known better. They should have seen it. They somehow should have known. And this story is our proof that even people who come here and talk to you about this stuff for an hour every week and spend a year and a half organizing an entire conference about it, full of our friends and loved ones who do nothing but talk about Cybersecurity Awareness Month to each other, it can happen to us too. Even the people that know don't always see it.
Yeah, and I think the you said shame spiral, is that the phrase you used?
Yeah.
I think the shame spiral or that type of sense of emotion prevents people from sharing when things happen. And that prevents the next person from knowing what's going on, right? If you haven't heard about this, and suddenly someone calls up and says, oh, by the way, your bank's under attack, and don't worry, we've saved you, we moved all your money. You've got a very limited ability to recognize that attack is happening. And so I think it's really impactful to share these types of events. And it's that sense of shame and sense of embarrassment that keeps us from sharing. And we know the criminals share, right? They share practices all the time. Which puts the good guys, the victims, at a disadvantage.
Yeah, and so that's why, you know, we wanted to tell the story of Stephanie being so distracted that when somebody asks for her password, she literally types the word password. That is not a story that makes me look intelligent, friends.
So let's talk about a couple ways that this could have been defeated. First off, when the bank texts you asking for a password, that's probably a good indicator that it's not the bank. They should never ask you for a password or a PIN. Now, obviously, as I mentioned, they did ask us, both the real bank and the fraudulent bank, for SMS OTP or that second factor password. Interestingly, we went back into the bank this week, we're still reestablishing the account and everything. And they did the exact same thing. And I said, why do you guys keep doing this, right? So if you are on the bank fraud team, please do think of a better way to authenticate real people than doing the same tactics that the criminals are doing. Please, that would be lovely. So that is one indication. Another thing that's incredibly important. Now, this got left out of the story, but they also provided a case number through all this. So when a bank calls you, it's very easy to spoof a phone number, incredibly easy to spoof a phone number.
And just about anyone can do it. The phone number system is old and antiquated. It's going to happen. So if a bank calls you, call them back. Take the case number, take the information, call them back. We never want to do that because it's like, oh God, I'm going to be put on hold. It's going to take forever. And I get that. Totally get that. But call them back, because one of the things that made this look realistic and one of the things that made this possible to get this far is the fact that they called from the right banking number. So keep an eye on what they're asking and keep an ear out for anything that doesn't sound right. Call the bank, the number you have for the bank, to make sure that it is not a spoof number and it's right. And then just be ready to say, please hold, right? Be ready to pause if there seems to be high risk, if there seems to be a lot of pressure, if it seems to be like the person on the other phone isn't taking no for an answer or isn't being some, you know, if they're really pressuring into something, it's probably not real. It's probably not a good situation you're in.
Yeah. You know, in hindsight, I'm thinking back on all of my times working crisis lines, right? A good portion of my career has been working on crisis lines. And the thing is that the people that are helping you when you're in crisis should be the calmest people on the call. And when I had people calling to tell me that they were literally having their lives threatened in the very moment on the phone, my reaction, my training was never to become equally distressed and equally freaked out and start yelling back. And so, you know, in hindsight, as I reflect on this experience, it occurs to me that the sense of urgency from the caller should have been a red flag for me. The actual fraud people, when we got to a branch and called them, were unflappable to the point of frustrating. Like, I wanted them to take it a little bit more seriously because they were so calm. And that, I think, is one of my big takeaways, is that if somebody calls you and says, I'm trying to help you and I'm trying to help you right now, and why won't you let me help you? Oh, my God. They're probably not trying to help you. The people that are there to help you in a crisis are going to be calmer than you are. And if they're not, they're trying to rile you up. And I suspect they're not trying to help.
Absolutely. But we survived. The nonprofit survived. The event survived. The next day went much better, at least from the perspective of someone trying to empty out our bank account.
Day two of the conference was phenomenal. Like, day two goes way better when you've survived day one. And I think that's true for any event, but especially when you're fighting off an active, you know, sort of hack or criminal threat or any number of things. I like day two way better when people left us alone and we could just enjoy ourselves. And I don't mean our guests. I loved every conversation we had, but I mean, there were no outside adversaries actively trying to attack and destabilize our event. And that made it for a lovely conference. I highly recommend folks attend conferences where the organizers are not being breached.
Good advice. And I think we stayed up to like 2 a.m. both of those days, Thursday and Friday. We were definitely out for a long time with the friends and the audience. I want to play one more clip of audio from folks talking about what it was like to bring those communities together.
What has been your favorite session so far, and what did you like about it?
Okay, so I don't know if there's a particular session that's been my favorite, but I really love just the environment and like the community. I think it was like coming into it, I was kind of thinking, oh, how are like hackers and sexuality professionals, like how is that all going to tie together? And I think it's been really like a beautiful and very complimentary relationship. And I feel like we've both been able to learn so much from each other.
And that is what I'm most proud of, right? I was expecting people to tell us that they learned a lot or that they made some new network connections. What I was unprepared for was the number of people who told us that the best part about the Securing Sexuality Conference was that they could relax and be their authentic selves for 2 days without stress or worry or fear or pushback. And I heard that from so many different kinds of people from different professions and different walks of life and different relationships and different identities. And you and I try to foster kindness. And so it shouldn't surprise me, because that's what I want for people that hang out with us, is for people to feel like they can be themselves. But to have so many people use that word to say they could be their authentic selves and not have to worry and not have to be afraid was not what I thought the biggest thing would be. And that, I think, is what I'm most proud of. I am so grateful to everybody who came and helped us build a space where everybody could just be their genuine selves for 48 hours to learn together, to teach one another, to laugh together. Yes, at times to comfort one another. There were some distressing events that happened in my community in the middle of the conference. And there were moments where people who had flown in from across the country to teach were just holding my hand. And to have a space where that learning happened and that fun happened, that our original goals, right? Academic rigor and hacker fun, we made that happen. But to see the community that was built was, I wanted it, but I couldn't have possibly been prepared for just what it was. And I am so, so grateful to everybody that made that happen.
And we did it, right? It worked. It was quirky. It was weird. It was fun. So for those of you who were there for those couple days, thank you so much for coming out. I'm sorry we sold out. We are looking at ways to use more of the venue space for future events. But thank you for spending that time with us. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning into Securing Sexuality, your source of information you need to protect yourselves, your relationships, and your banking.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit that is still solvent, everyone. From the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate safe sex in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to more information about the topics we discussed here today, as well as our live events,
including photographs and feedback from last week's event. If you couldn't be there and you want to see what you missed, go and check out the pictures. If you were there and want to see photos of your new friends, go and check out the pictures. It's all on our website. And join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week.